The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
It's the same old disease. Why wait until tomorrow to purchase something when I actually have the savings instead of buying it today on credit? There are only two kinds of people in the world. There are those who pay interest and those that receive it. And those that pay it are not victims of the system. They're not at the end of an evil banking cobble. They are victims of their own ignorance.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Last week, Dave, I pointed out that we're not just a gold permeable program. You know, there are times when you can look and say, you know, I think it's going to correct a little bit and it might be time to add. Last week when we did the show, gold was pushing $1,300 an ounce. And we've had, what, about a $35 correction to the downside since then. So I would have to say, good call.
Well, and certainly that kind of a correction can extend itself even further. But the reality is, if you're looking at the big picture, something significant changed in the month of April 2016. And it's something that is a part of history already, but people won't see its significance probably for another 6, 12, 18 months. And that is the yuan-denominated gold contract that settles in physical kilo bars, which is now sponsored by the Shanghai Gold Exchange, was launched on April 19th. So to me, what you're seeing is a continuation of a theme that's been in place for several years. Central banks have been accumulating gold since 2009. Individual investors throughout Asia, India always, but particularly China right now, have been taking physical delivery of metals. And now this is a specific contract denominated, again, in their local currency, but with a unique design. You don't settle this contract in cash.
In paper.
This is settled with physical kilo bars. And it reminds me of the paper games, which continued to be played in London and New York, and sort of the power trip that those traders have, where they're working with $200 billion in gold contracts, that's paper only, and those trade hands every day.
Well, and that's more than annual supply on a daily basis, but they're playing a paper game. They don't have to own the gold itself.
Well, it's equal to 5,724 tons of purchasing each day. And that's, as you say, it's well above 2015's mine production, 182% of 2015's total mine production.
On a daily basis.
On a daily basis. 5,724 tons of purchasing, that's paper contracts, and it more and more resembles a game of musical chairs. Mm. You've got the physical players in China who suck out the above ground supply that's coming off the markets, and it's like chairs being removed from the game at a very rapid clip. Mm. When the music stops, again, 200 billion is the total number. If you look at just the purchase side as opposed to the liquidation side, 100 billion, half of the total traded, that's looking for a seat.
Well, I think the musical chairs analogy is perfect because that gold doesn't really exist. In other words, that chair doesn't really exist. Now, the London and the New York market have always had a backdoor approach. They said, well, if the gold doesn't exist, we'll just go ahead and settle it in paper cash. But like you said, Shanghai, it has to settle in gold. I mean, these are kilo bars. A kilo bar looks a little bit like a candy bar, but it's a little heavier.
It's the exact size of the current iPhone.
Okay. Well, there you go.
But it's gold, and you're right. It's a lot heavier. And no, you've got evidence which is growing that the above ground stocks of gold in the largest global gold market, that is in London, they're moving into deficit. And so when you look at this group of paper traders, if there is any shift in preference for settlement in kind, which is to take physical metals instead of in paper, that will remake the gold market as we've known it over the last four decades. And it just comes to mind that you should own what you want to own, because the Chinese are going to bring you true price discovery of an asset that's been controlled by a paper manipulated price and quite frankly, very distant from any real supply and demand dynamics for decades.
Well, let's unpack this a little bit then. All right. You said if there's any shift in preference for delivery. All right. Now, the reason there hasn't been a shift in preference for delivery is people are perfectly fine taking paper assets at this point. But let's look at what Deutsche Bank just now said about negative interest rates. It's not enough. People are not spending. At what point do people preferentially pull cash out of the bank and then go for the double run and actually move it to gold, something that can't be printed?
Well, and that's something we talked about last week in terms of a migration and a preference away from cash, away from bonds, and in the direction of gold. And it was analyst Dominic Konstrom from Deutsche Bank who said recently that, and frankly, we've kind of anticipated this a little bit, credit growth, in his opinion, is not happening right now with low rates. So really, what he suggests as a necessary solution is to lower rates even more.
Right.
Take them negative, and in his words, penalize savers via a negative retail deposit rate and introduce a wealth tax. And I know that in somebody's twisted economic theory, that may work, but you are disconnected from the way people think and behave as if more lending is going to occur, as if it's somehow inspirational, this notion of a stick versus the carrot. It reminds me of how you know when you've come across an addict, when the cure for every ill is some kind of external stimulant. And in this case, we're talking about the stolen money from the average saver. Negative rates is nothing more than stealing money from a depositor. And I'm telling you, there are enough policymakers that think like this particular bank analyst. And I don't think they've studied behavioral psychology. I don't think they recognize that stealing from people is not endearing. And it's not even inspiring, as that concept to them looks so clear as a solution on paper. Yes, if we just lower rates into the negative territory, that's going to stimulate more credit expansion in the economy and thus growth in the economy. And it seems to me that they didn't study broadly enough. I mean, because we are really talking about how someone at the behavioral level, at the psychological level, responds to something the equivalent of economic electroshock therapy.
Yeah, but you know, they have equations that allow them to think insanely. I hate to say it, but sometimes when you have an equation that works mathematically, but it doesn't work practically, it allows somewhat irrational thought to continue. And, you know, I'm going to just bring something back up, Dave. Your dad taught me back in 1987. I mean, this goes back almost 30 years, but he was explaining the bank runs of the 1930s. And here's what he said. He said it came in three forms. First, you had a lateral run. In other words, what happened was people started looking at the institutions and they moved from one bank to another, be it for interest rates, be it for safety. In this case, back in the 1930s, it was for safety. And then he said it moves to the second step. He called it the in and out, which people realize they're not getting enough reward for the risk that they're taking leaving it in the bank. So they pull it out in cash. But there's something that your dad called a double run. And this was actually occurring in the 1930s. And that's when a person prefers something tangible to the actual cash. And back in the 1930s, of course, before the confiscation, a person could hold a $20 bill or they could hold a 1 ounce $20 gold piece. Now, we have a sequence very similar occurring, maybe for different reasons, but you have first this lateral run. We've been seeing money moving since the crisis from place to place. Now we're seeing the in and out. There's cash coming out because people are getting either zero or negative rates. The double run, however, is the third phase of an all-out bank run. And that's when you're talking about people changing their preference from cash payment to physical settlement. This is where they move out of cash itself.
Well, I think that's very interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that because that's not something I've ever heard from my dad before. And there's all kinds of things that I think he shared around the office that, frankly, I wish he had shared around the dinner table and just never got around to it, I suppose. That's very interesting, the notion of a double run, because really what you do have in terms of the exchanges being shy of gold and the London market currently operating in sort of a deficit position. When you count all the metals that are held for various parties and then consider the amount of metals that are traded each day, it's interesting because all of it ties to one word, confidence.
Hmm.
Confidence. And as long as confidence is there, you don't have a run. But we've seen the erosion of confidence starting back in 2000, 2001. And it's been gradual and it's migrated. And yes, it accelerated with the global financial crisis in 08 and 09. But for investors, confidence began to be challenged when you had the likes of Arthur Andersen, who all of a sudden are caught in this sort of fraudulent behavior relating to Enron and Pacific Gas and Electric and price fixing and price of natural gas and energy and the dirty trade that was happening there.
Right.
And all that was being obfuscated, not only in corporate America, where people said, well, you know, caveat emptor, but you could always trust the accountants. And so this major fissure in the mind of investors is, wait a minute, maybe you can't trust even the most trustworthy. And so that was, I think, what started a multi-decade decline in confidence. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was exaggerated and accelerated in the 2008-2009 period. And in the last stage, which I think does encompass the double run, the last stage of a breaking of confidence will tie to people's views of the central bank, people's views to the monetary instrument itself.
Well, Dave, like this Deutsche Bank analyst is suggesting lower rates. And if that doesn't work, lower rates. And if that doesn't work, lower rates. But we also know that he's going towards some sort of form of people control. Now, we're not used to people control here in the West because of democracy, republic, representative government. But, you know, we've seen this experiment for the last 30 or 40 years in China. There's been an enormous wealth effect in China based on the fact that we decided to go into debt and buy their stuff, and they decided to buy our debt. The problem is China itself is running so much debt, they're going to probably have to resort to good old-fashioned Chinese, possibly slash communist control of the people because the prosperity is leaving the country.
And depending on what side you take, I mean, if you're a China watcher, you may view things through the lens of international relations. You may view them through the lens of economics and economic statistics. You may view them through the lens of an investor looking for an opportunity, either because you see a currency that may appreciate or a stock or a bond that looks like an opportunity. It's been a number of years, but we interviewed Martin Jakes, and we explored the idea of China economically and geopolitically dominating the world in the 21st century.
Well, and he was pro-Marxist. I mean, you have to understand, this is a man who, he felt like control of the people was the right thing to do.
I know. So, again, we don't always agree with the guests that we have on the program, but as a neo-Marxist, Jakes saw what he wanted to see in the growth figures.
Mm-hmm.
That may have been 5 to 7 years ago, but he concluded that a command economy was superior to the free markets, and his sort of exhibit A for that was China came rocketing out of the global financial crisis long before Europe and the United States. And as it turns out, you know, rocketing out of the global financial crisis was just a question of the jet fuel they were using, the rocket fuel they were using in the form of massive amounts of debt, which brings us to this idea of, you know, a coming debt bust in China. Does that happen? You know, when writers discuss the collapse of China instead of its unstoppable progress, they usually sort of conjure up some catastrophic terms. And yes, certainly things could turn out very poorly. Yes, Chinese GDP, that is debt to GDP, exceeds 290%. Yes, Chinese credit growth reflects the law of diminishing returns. It takes 4 of their local currency units, the yuan or the RMB, in new debt for 1 yuan in GDP growth.
So what you're saying is I'll gladly borrow 4 yuan today for just 1 yuan in growth today.
Right. And now you've got bad debts, which are rising. So are we worried or aren't we? And I have to say, just as a disclaimer, I haven't had any direct investments in China since selling out a Chinese life insurance company several years ago. But what we are worried about is the seemingly endless ability of governmental authorities, authoritarian or democratic, so either on this side of the Pacific or that, to sweep problems under the carpet. In essence, to cater to the now and the constituencies of the present at the expense of future generations. And it is a universal issue. So back to China. The numbers are bad. The numbers are getting worse. However, the numbers are not far off from U.S. figures.
Right.
You look at private corporate governmental debt, inclusive of the financial sector here in the U.S., and the U.S. is awfully close to 300% debt to GDP. And it does take us over $4.50 growth in debt to create a dollar of GDP growth. So we, frankly, are both in a tough spot. And I think China is more practiced at crowd control. They're more practiced at limiting expressions of discontent. And so to some degree, by threat of force, they may be able to control a process of unwinding bad debts. I mean, it's not like we can't do that or haven't done that. I'm sure they've learned from what we did here in the West, that the value of vehicles like Maiden Lane 1, Maiden Lane 2, do you remember the special purpose vehicles that the Fed established to absorb the bad paper sort of until the storms blew over? So collapse is not a concern as much as the continual practice of tinkering to create a perfect economic machine, and then more tinkering when the machine has problems.
Well, okay, but let's talk about that for a second, because yes, the U.S. government is in the same trouble. I mean, they have to borrow more than $4 to get a dollar's worth of growth. We still control the world militarily. We still control the world with a reserve currency. Now, China's been knocking at that door, but it seems that the U.S. has gotten away with it because we basically borrow in our own currency and let the rest of the world borrow in our currency. But remember what Michael Pettis said. Okay, when you have a command economy, or when you have an economy that's sort of a mixture of both, when it snaps one side or the other, it's going to be violent.
It's more violent.
That was his concern.
But that's exactly right. So I think the PR campaigns of virtually every government and central bank around the world have included the message, you know, move along, everything's fine, we're the experts, we have it under control, which to a degree they do, but only to a degree. And that's where the real problems crop up, not only here, but in China. If everyone believes you are the master of the universe and you turn out to be a mere mortal, there is a breaking of confidence. There is a breaking of social trust. Back to that issue of confidence. What keeps everything in motion is one word. And so you realize why there's so many games that are played to create impressions,
right,
and in hopes that those impressions will change behaviors.
Well, let's talk about a time when confidence was suddenly broken, Dave. Let's go ahead and go to Germany in the early 1920s. In Germany in the 1920s, you actually had slight deflationary pressures, 1, 2, 3% inflation at the max. And then confidence was broken in the paper mark at that time. And we went into a hyperinflationary change. And, you know, I'm thinking about what Albert Edwards was outlining, what he sees going forward when that break of confidence occurs.
Yeah, the sequence of events was interesting because you had deficit spending, and obviously the Germans were in a very difficult position dealing with the war operations from Treaty of Versailles.
Right.
And, you know, it was basically an unbearable burden. So massive deficit spending, they exhausted the debt markets domestically because they didn't have access to the international debt markets. And as soon as the debt markets were full to capacity. Imagine a sponge that just can't take another drop of water. It is fully soaked. That's the domestic economy in Germany.
You can't borrow another mark and it won't help.
Then the printing presses were the only solution. The only way that they could pay bills and get anything done was following the Haverstein message of we can print our way to prosperity. And, you know, it was Albert Edwards. He's kind of the Uber bear at Societe Generale, who suggests that this chapter in economic history, it winds down with social and political chaos for precisely this reason. He says this, as the equity markets spiral into a deep bear market, as it ends with corporate bond spreads exploding, in other words, the yields on corporate bonds getting much bigger than what you would see relative to a risk-free rate, like the interest rate you'd see on treasuries. It ends with social unrest. It ends with double-digit budget deficits. It ends with investors losing faith with the Fed. It ends with deeply negative rates, with currency and trade wars, with helicopter money, and ultimately inflation. I think it's an interesting time. And again, it ties back to this issue of confidence.
Mm. Yeah, when confidence is broken, you don't go into a deflation, Dave. You go into an inflation because the confidence has been placed on the value of a promise. And that promise is just a piece of paper. So when we talk about a break in confidence, and this is why I was bringing up Germany earlier, it's sort of a shock to the system when you don't have any inflation. And, you know, look at our central bankers now. They've taught the people to fear deflation. They're not even mentioning inflation, except for when they say, well, we'd like a little of it. That's all.
Well, another one of our commentary guests, Harold James, last month, he put together a piece of the puzzle, which I thought was pretty fascinating. He put the piece of the puzzle right in the right place. What he describes as Europe's generational war. Generational, not sort of class, but generational war, where the demographic pyramid is rapidly inverting.
Which is where the older people are outnumbering the young people?
That's right. So he argues a war of generations is as likely as that of a war between classes. And he sees it already emerging in Germany and Poland. And I don't know if he's coined this phrase or not, but what he calls a gerontocracy. Hmm. And here's the puzzle piece. What does helicopter money look like? When we listened to Ben Bernanke 2002, when he packaged that concept in Draghi's 2016 suggestion of the same, here it is in real time in both Germany and Poland. What does helicopter money look like? Governments are catering in these geographies to a bloated constituency, a very large group of people that determines the outcome of an election. So when you look at Germany, when you look at Poland, it's the old people that determine elections. So if you've ever imagined a helicopter just dropping money from the sky and sort of the indiscriminate, just hold out a bucket and it's going to be filled with C notes, $100 bills or 500 euro notes, which by the way, were done away with as of this last week in Europe, will go into effect in 2018. When you imagine this sort of money for all, that's not really the nature of helicopter money. Germany recently announced a 5% increase in retirement age pension benefits.
That is a huge, I mean, look at Social Security here in America. They didn't even raise it even a percent this year.
It's the largest rise since 1993. And as James points out, the reason there was a big increase in 93 is because Germany was battling an inflation beast. So no such beast or excuse exists today. You've got Poland, which has done the same thing. It's decreasing their pension age and increasing payments. And both of these are places that are struggling with public budgets. So your public budgets are under pressure, yet they have no problem spending money on these particular constituency groups. Isn't it interesting that Angela Merkel is in a fight for her political life? You know, she is under a tremendous amount of pressure and is being blamed for many of the missteps. Some of it's related to the migrant issue. But generally speaking, the economy is not booming. They've done everything that they can to see a minor uptick in inflation. In fact, you see more deflationary trends all the time. So again, why a 5% increase? Well, I think you get some clarity on this when you come back across the pond and go south. Dilma Rousseff in Brazil has a different bloated constituency group that she's wanting to influence. You may know that impeachment proceedings are in motion based on the Brazilian leader's very close ties to a number of people at the center of the Petrobras scandal.
Anytime you're about to be impeached, it's a good time to print a little bit of money and give it away.
That's right. So as the proceedings have intensified, it's no surprise. There she is, while she still can. She's increasing housing subsidies and offering other freebies to the working poor. And lo and behold, the negative numbers, which she did have just 2 weeks ago, are improving. They may not improve enough to get her out of the hot seat. But again, it's this combination of fiscal measures with what, if you consider, you know, the source, Mario Draghi and Ben Bernanke, kind of the idea leaders of helicopter money. When you can use the public treasury and then deliver to a particular group, you get the benefit of not only giving money away, but also guaranteeing a certain political longevity.
Well, and this is not a new concept. I mean, we all have heard the giving away of bread and circuses in Rome, okay, as Rome was completely crumbling from the foundations. The bread and circuses were flowing freely.
It was a combination, because with Diocletian, you had not only the experiment with price controls, but ultimately dealing with a collapsing currency. He pulled out all the stops and said, you know, the real reason for the chaos that we have financially
is
due to this group over here who believes in one versus many gods. And so he actually played the scapegoat card, and the bread and circuses, a part of those circuses were watching human beings being eaten in real time by lions right? So, I mean, to what extent do politicians do whatever it takes to stay in office?
To satisfy the constituency. And I was thinking about this morning because my wife and I were talking about the election. And I've got to admit, Dave, I was just lamenting the futility of the way this election is playing out here in America. It seems that we don't really have any good choices. But it hit me. We still have representative government. It's not like the United States has lost representative government. The problem is the people that they're representing are not me. And I realize that I am a minority at this point, and the government's going to represent the constituency that has the most power, the most sway. It's just not a constituency that I particularly agree with.
And ultimately the most votes. Well, James argues that the war to be fought is over the spoils of the national budget, and that takes place at the ballot box. And he believes that young people tend to stay home while older generations are the ones that determine and win elections. So you've got politicians, which are focused on the present, which James argues has very far-reaching consequences. And when any generation focuses primarily on their needs, they're in essence breaking what Edmund Burke saw as a social contract. Harold James argues this, quoting Edmund Burke, who says a social contract is not just among those who are living, as he said a few hundred years ago, but with those who are dead and those who are to be born. Mm-hmm. And Harold then asks, well, what motive would government have to be a trustee for unknown people at the expense of real and present voters? And so this is the puzzle piece. The puzzle piece in question is, how do you make helicopter money seem legitimate to the greatest number of people? How do you hand out cash and make sure that it's spent immediately? So this does not have sort of an egalitarian theme. This is not about equality. That doesn't come into the frame at all. If a politician is going to hand out dollars, it will be for votes.
Right.
And so you must ask, what are the groups where these handouts would be accepted without question? Try the experiment on anyone you know who's living on a fixed income today. Ask them this. Could you use an extra $2,500 of income this year? This is getting to what James is talking about, a gerontocracy in Europe. It applies to many parts of Asia, and within a few years, it might even apply here in the U.S. Certainly the most powerful lobby group today in D.C.,
is the AARP. In fact, you know, it's funny that you're bringing this up, Dave, because I've been surprised talking to clients who are very constitutional oriented. They're very balanced budget oriented, but they're also very retired. And when anything looks politically like it might threaten their Social Security or Medicare, it doesn't matter the party. They're typically going to vote their pocketbook. Now, I'm not saying that's for everyone, but I've been shocked at people who seem to live by a strong ideal but compromise that ideal when it has to do with the monthly budget.
Right. So principle becomes secondary to the practical needs of paying bills.
Right.
It was a recent GAO study, a Government Accountability Office report, which confirms that 60% of all U.S. households have no savings in individual retirement accounts, whether that's a personal retirement account or a company-sponsored one. So again, this notion of retirees who need a little extra income, you know that it's going to get spent, and that was a part of the problem with this last QE experiment, boosting asset prices, hoping that the wealth effect would cause massive amounts of spending, and it didn't. But if you give to a whole host of people who are living on a fixed income a little bit more money, do you think it's going to go into savings?
Right.
No, those years are past.
But the younger generation is going to have to end up paying for the excesses necessarily that are applied to the older generation.
So it seems like there's two forks in the road which are ahead of us. Should this form of helicopter money become sort of too much for a younger generation to tolerate, assuming that the younger generation connects these dots and knows that from their paycheck to the direct income of a Social Security recipient here in the United States, or as we mentioned in Germany, the same thing's happening as in Poland, what do they do? Well, labor mobility is the best form of protest. You move away.
Mm-hmm.
You drop out. You quit. You just say, look, no, I'm not doing this. I'm going someplace else. And I guess the second fork in the road is like what we saw in Ireland. Years ago, Ireland decided to implement unique policies, encourage innovation, encourage capital formation, encourage capital investment, and the brain drain that they saw all throughout the 80s, where a lot of talented Irishmen and women who had left the country, guess what? They came back, and Ireland was able to draw on those skills. And the workers, young and at every age, really had lots of opportunity.
Well, and I think, Dave, it's important to point out that this is not an indictment on the elderly. They have to have some means of living, but it is
far from
it's a picture of constituency controlling political choices, you know, to the ill effect sometimes of future generations.
Right. Far from it. It's not an indictment of the elderly. It's an indictment of a global political class that will stop at nothing to maintain power. And opportunistically look around and survey the voting landscape to see where money should be handed out. So helicopter money does not, nor will it in the future, fall from the sky on everyone equally, but is targeted to not only boost aggregate demand, as the economist would say, but also perpetuate political power, which is far more meaningful to an elected official. So if you're Merkel, if you're Rousseff, if you're Clinton or Trump, call it a shovel-ready project, a housing subsidy, or a change in Social Security payments. These are political choices which reflect not merely party politics, but individual politicians maneuvering to survive from one election to the next.
Well, Dave, we wouldn't have this discussion if we weren't able to print money or go into unlimited debt. You know, savings. What happened to the old days when savings were actually what paid for future retirement, paid for future projects? You know, people used to have to save before they spent. Now that's really not part of the economic model, is it?
No, it's not. You know, one of the guys that has highlighted this 10 years ago, John Templeton said, look, the Chinese are saving roughly 51% of their income. Savings can be understood in a slightly different way than just households socking away that much dough in the mattress. They aren't actually saving 51%. But his point, I think, was well taken. They are a saving culture. We've become a spending culture. And someone who echoed this recently is Stephen Roach. Spent a lot of time in Asia as well, understands China very well. And he was an economist at Morgan Stanley while I was with the firm. Now he teaches at Yale. He was one of those guys that flew a million miles a year while with Morgan Stanley. And I can't blame him for wanting to teach and yeah. maybe enjoy the East Coast a little bit more. But what he was saying basically reflects on economic growth. And what he posits is that savings are the seed corn of economic growth, because savings precede investment. And investment is what goes into infrastructure, new capacity, technology, etc. And without the pool of capital that is created by people living beneath their means, which allows for savings to accrue, the middle class, he would argue, is at risk. And so the flip side of that is, if you live beyond your means, all you're really doing is bringing tomorrow's enjoyments into the present, and you're leaving nothing but interest payments and memories for the future.
See, that's the thing that we're starting to face here in America. We're not just paying back our debt. As soon as interest rates rise, we're going to be paying just interest on that debt. We're not really paying any debt back. It reminds me of when you first buy a house and you look at the difference between principal and interest. All you're doing is paying interest in the beginning of paying for a house. The problem is, let's flip that. At the end of a debt cycle, all you're doing is paying interest, and you're not getting any of the principal paid down at all.
Well, and it certainly is money that could go towards other things, more productive than just paying off the banks. So in China, the high percentage of Chinese corporations, 16% of the 1,000 largest corporations in China, have interest payments which exceed their income. Interest payments which exceed the amount of money that's coming in. So in good times, debt seems like a way to stay ahead of the competition, to grow faster, or from the consumer's vantage point, to stay ahead of the Joneses. But in bad times, or just say leaner times, those debt obligations become outsized burdens. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in real time with certain Chinese corporations. I think you'll see it with certain U.S. corporations as well, who've decided to leverage up and take on a lot of debt at these low rates. I don't blame them for being interested in the low rates, but what they have to consider is how they're going to roll over that debt in the future, how they're going to extinguish the liability as and when rates increase. So, unfortunately, what Roach is concerned about is a cultural issue. It's a cultural issue of priorities before it becomes an economic issue with consequences.
Well, we talked about equations that actually allow you to think irrationally. There's an equation that tells you that you have to take on a certain amount of debt to be able to grow. Richard Duncan brings that up. He says, you know, at this point, because we have so much debt, we have to take out a certain amount of debt every year in addition to that, just to show growth. Otherwise, we sink into a depression.
And this is where clearly we're on the horns of a dilemma as a group. Do we like debt? No. Do we recognize that the system is debt addicted? And without more of it, we might end up with paralysis or death? Yes. So pragmatically, what do you do? How do you respond to that? Well, we have consumer debt, which is on the rise again. It's growing at the fastest pace since 2001. And that is viewed as a good thing, according to the modern paradigm. So from the Richard Duncan perspective, if debts don't grow fast enough, we'll face a financial reckoning of cataclysmic proportions.
And he's probably right.
Right. But is it good to see the consumer spending more? I mean, from the vantage point of a father, I am one, you are, and someday grandfather, it's the same old disease. Why wait until tomorrow to purchase something when I actually have the savings instead of buying it today on credit? If you step back, you can see that there are only two kinds of people in the world. There are those who pay interest and those that receive it. And those that pay it are not victims of the system. They're not at the end of an evil banking cobble. They are victims of their own ignorance, lacking, perhaps, a preceding generation to tell them, as a father or grandfather would, as a mother or grandmother would, that it's better to save than to spend. So you have the graying generation in America today, which rebelled against an earlier American practice of thrift, and they've proven to not be the greatest generation of the years past, but the most selfish, frankly. And their children know only that as a paradigm, that by example. The legacies we leave, you know this, they will either pay homage to the sensible things life has taught us and we pass on from one generation to the next, or they will be a permanent testament to social amnesia and foolishness. And I fear that the addiction to debt at every level in our society today, it supports the latter.
Yeah, Dave, for many years I had a fortune that I had kept from a fortune cookie that had a simple concept on it, but I think it's what you're saying. Better a hen tomorrow than an egg today. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.